It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow. Wherever you are, tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do it. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
MintMobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 5/31/24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
Hello, I'm Matt Kelly.
And I'm Matt D'Ancona.
And this is the all-new Two Mats for the week ending Friday, the 10th of May. Now with disagreements, it says here.
Now with added disagreements.
We do. We don't fall out, but we do have a good...
It's not domestic.
No.
No, we didn't have to call the Rozzers, but I really enjoyed it, actually. I think you should be more of it.
And I think you're right. We... conversations like the one that is about to follow are absolutely essential, I think.
And they are too few in number because politeness is an overrated virtue sometimes. Fuck off. Go fuck yourself. And there you have it, ladies and gentlemen, the founder of the new European.
What did we argue about?
We argued about Gaza and then we agreed cloyingly about Withnall and I.
We did. And Bernard Hill.
It was like makeup podcasting.
It was. Well, I hope you guys enjoy it. This is the Two Mats, episode 44. Thank you for listening.
Enjoy.
So, Matt, what are we talking about this week?
Well, there's lots on, but I've been dwelling, brooding even, upon a point you made on a previous podcast about the whole Gaza conflict being like a pebble.
Or
a rock that's sort of hit the water and sent ripples literally everywhere. And that, in turn, reminded me of the New Yorker writer Dexter Filkin's book, The Forever War, about Afghanistan and Iraq. But... it's sort of like Gaza is turning out very, you know, in very short order, 7 months, to be the everywhere war.
Yes.
And it, you know, it, I thought it'd be interesting to talk about the way, I mean, there's lots we can say about what's going on specifically this week in terms of the conflict itself, but also how it's spread everywhere in the culture. And I thought one of the, because this is the week of the Eurovision Song Contest, and we're recording this on Thursday, which is the night of the second semi-final, most of the oxygen into this traditionally sort of quite fun and jolly occasion has been sucked up by the fact that Israel is competing, as it often does. It's actually hosted it three times.
Yeah.
And the entrant is a singer, 20-year-old singer called Eden Golden. And I thought it might be interesting to just to take a clip of a interview she did with ITV News, giving a taste of like what it's like to be a, you know, a Eurovision Song Contest contestant.
Yes.
Suddenly in the middle of this.
Yeah. There's a lot of people saying that you shouldn't be here. How do you take that?
People can say whatever they want. They have a right to speak their mind, speak their heart. I'm focusing on my mission and on the good and on the fact that we are united here by music. I'm a singer. That's the entire point. I'm not everything else. I'm a singer. I create music.
So you get a taste of it, I guess. She's not right in the sense that they're not united by music.
No.
Witness the fact that, and this is, when I read this, I was really blown away that the head of Shin Bet, which is the, you know, tough guy security agency, the Israeli security agency, Ronan Bar, has actually been to see the site in Malmo, right?
So, right.
And then in terms of being united, well, you know, we've already had the wonderfully named Irish contestant Bambi Thug, who I think kind of I wanted to win already, right?
Yeah.
It told reporters that she'd been forced to change. She'd got a subliminal message on in various messages written on her face and leg in an ancient Irish language, which read "ceasefire and freedom for Palestine." And
right,
they were told
right.
can't have that. And
and the Israeli contestant, she's had to change the lyrics.
She had to change the lyrics. Yeah. It was originally called, not too subtly, "October Rain." I think we can all guess what that was about. And then a Swedish singer who took part in one of the events this week, because it's turned into a big jamboree now, the Eurovision Song Contest, appeared on stage with his wrist wrapped in a kefir, a sort of Palestinian symbol. So that's got him into trouble. And Ollie Alexander, who will be in the final, because
he's the British
British contestant, and he gets in. I didn't know this. The British contestant gets in automatically.
What, like this? We've got a security council.
There is a Eurovision security council, right? So Ollie Alexander is going to compete on Saturday, but he's been under huge pressure from groups like Queers for Palestine to withdraw, and has spoken out about, you know, a similar sort of line about we're here to do music. And,
yeah.
But I guess the reason that it may be an odd way in, but it did occur to me, apropos of your remark of the stone falling into the
ripples,
that you know, when we were kind of did our first podcast after October the 7th and sort of shell-shocked, you know, just wondering where it was going.
Yeah.
I mean, it was obviously something new, something terrible. We correctly anticipated that the Israeli retaliation would be, you know, a terrible slaughter, and it has been. I don't think either of us would have guessed that we'd be sitting here in May talking about the impact of the conflict on the Eurovision Song Contest.
It has been an absolutely incredible after effect, hasn't it?
Yes, I mean, it has.
In every regard and at every level. The fact that, you know, we've seen this, and we can talk about the horrific scale of the retribution that's been visited upon Gaza, the awful trauma that the Israelis are still going through with many hostages still missing. You know, that was, I guess, kind of the predictable side of things.
Yes, I mean, I think we would have said, and I think we did say, you know, Benjamin Netanyahu, not a great person to have at the helm in a crisis like this.
Yeah.
Hamas, you know, brutally committed to a kind of human sacrifice strategy where civilians were packed into, you know, very heavily populated areas, which would be targets.
Yeah.
This was not going to go well. I think the kind of military combat side of things we would perhaps have predicted. But there's a sort of cultural dimension to this, which is political as well. But it's the way that it's seeped into the bones of the entire kind of global culture. I mean, just looking at local elections, you know, people are still scouring the local election results for meaning and what does this mean, you know. And you have a lead city councillor called Muthin Ali, a Green councillor, and he after he was elected in the Gipton and Hare Hills ward in Leeds said Allah Akbar and declared his victory a win for the people of Gaza. And then of course people started doing social media archaeology on him and found that on the day of October the 7th Ali had said on social media that the Palestinians had the right to fight back on the day itself. So without going into the rights and wrongs of it, and you know, the point has been made, and I think this is legitimate, that Allah Akbar is, although we've become used to it as a sort of in the context of suicide terrorists.
Yeah, but it's just
it just means God is great, right?
Course,
right.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
That I think you
in
know,
Morocco the other where we were in Morocco the other day. Of course, every prayer chant that goes out starts Allah Akbar.
Right.
You
so I think that
normal.
Getting worked out about that is saying it's a win for the people of Gaza just seems to me untrue. But you know, he's entitled, it seems to me, to say that. But what I'm you know, without getting into the sort of weeds of the rights and wrongs, I think it is interesting that this is now something of an issue for Labour. I mean, it was interesting that independent candidates made net gains of 93 seats and you know, losing control of a place like Oldham for the first time in 13 years. There is a backlash.
I think there are two elements or layers of that backlash that they need to worry about very intensely. One is the obvious, the Muslim layer, where increasingly they are there's a disassociation with Labour because of the policy of twinning with Sunak's kind of policy with Israel, which you can say whatever you like, you know, but Starmer hasn't gone out on a limb on it, which is what they want him to do.
They haven't broken bipartisanship, put
but
it
the
that
other,
way.
The other layer, which I find much more interesting, is the generational layer.
Yes, yeah.
And the fact that young people have adopted this cause.
100%. Know? And I think that leads us, nice segue, as we've learned to say, onto campuses.
Yeah.
And we've talked a bit about America, and we should perhaps talk a bit more about what's been going on campuses. But it's interesting that the protests have now spread in not as big a scale as they have in America, but to the UK and to Ireland, where in Trinity College Dublin, today, Thursday, the university authorities have agreed to divest from Israel. So, you know, that's
right,
quite
right.
a big,
yeah.
you know, moment. Then on the mainland, you've got 100 students storming the Library of Goldsmiths in London. You've got students at the University of Edinburgh beginning a hunger strike. You've got 14 or 15 encampments, not on the scale of America, but it's real and it's happening.
Yeah.
And today, Thursday, Rishi Sunak met university vice chancellors to talk about anti-Semitism on campuses. And so, you know, it's now a clear and present issue in British higher education as well as American higher education.
And just to dot the I's, the thing they want when you speak about the divestment from Israel.
Yes, sorry, I should have said.
There is a comprehensive list, isn't it, of companies that
I mean,
are active in Israel, and they want people to back away from them.
Universities in this country don't have anything like the wealth that universities in America do. But to the extent that they do and they invest, you know, there are companies that are directly invested in Israel or indirectly. And so that has always been a big, I mean, long before October the 7th and this conflict, has long been a demand of pro-Palestinian students, you know, that universities not invest in Israel.
Yeah.
But this has become much more heated. And so there's that. And then there's the Jewish students saying in ways formal and informal, well, look, you know, okay, everyone has the right to protest. And I, as you know, ferociously believe in that right. But at the same time, people have the right not to be harassed on campus. So, and this is where it gets tricksy, because what the language means means different things to different people. So to Jewish ears, globalized intifada means kill all Jews.
Right.
You know, the debate on what is Zionism can easily tip into the anti-Semitic trope that Jews do not have the right to self-determination in their own state.
Yeah.
And you know, more sort of straightforwardly, the incidents that are clocking up of Jewish students feeling they can't wear symbols of their Jewishness on campus and that they're being shouted at and so on. You know, this is a very fraught environment, and it speaks to a perception, I think, that a lot of progressive students in this country and in America think that the foundation of the State of Israel in 1948 was a greater historic injustice than the Holocaust.
Yes.
And that is obviously, you know,
contestable.
Contestable, but also it creates, you know, I'm conflicted, because I don't like the line that, you know, there shouldn't be protests, there shouldn't be, because I, you know, although I've sort of said some pro-Israel things, I absolutely 100% believe, you know, in the idea of the university, the idea that it should be a place of free speech, free assembly. You know, if you don't like what Israel's doing in Gaza, you know, have at it, you know, have your encampment, say things, speak up. That's the point of being, you know. But at the same time, I want Jewish students to be able to go about their business.
So one thing that I heard recently, which I suddenly fell into sympathy with this young woman who was an American student, can't remember her name, can't remember which university, I think it was Columbia, but she was describing, she was on the Palestinian side, and she was describing what they wanted and the efforts that they were taking on the campus and why they were so passionate about it. And this question was raised about the Jewish students. And she said, well, some of my fellow students confuse discomfort with harassment.
Yeah.
And I did think, and of course, like everything, there's a spectrum here. And like everything in this row, nothing is black and white. Nothing is clear. But I did think there is, on both sides, a tendency to remember that words are words, you know, and that an argument can be had. Well, and there's nothing, until someone punches you in the face, then you shouldn't really be afraid of
that.
I mean, yes,
except that I think that we can agree that when free speech tumbles into sort of racial harassment, neither of us are.
So, but I don't think that, is that what, I don't,
well, it, you know,
is that it, what's happening?
Yes. I mean, in Colombia, the Go Back to Poland slogan, I think, was pretty
really?
Clear. Yeah.
I didn't see that.
Yeah. Right. And we don't want no Zionists here. And then a particular leader who has been disciplined, Kamani James, who said Zionists don't deserve to live. But I think the other thing that Jewish students want is a level playing field, because it is nothing short of hilarious to hear pro-Palestinian protesters on American campuses talking about, you know, basically man up to Jewish students, when every other minority group on American campuses had been declaring for the last 5 years that they have a right to a safe space, that they feel, you know, physically and psychologically attacked by the presence of speakers on campus. I mean, which is it?
Yeah.
Is it that...
Well, does it have to be either or?
Yes, yes, of course it does. Because, you know, you have... If you incline, as I do, and I think you do, to the everyone has to put up with a measure of discomfort.
Yeah.
Right? Not everything that is offensive is, in fact, not much that is offensive amounts to harassment.
Yes.
But it is incontestable for the last 10 to 15 years, especially 2014, and Jonathan Haidt, the excellent American psychologist, has plotted this brilliantly. You know, American campuses have become zones where all sorts of forms of speech about trans, about Black Lives Matter, about Me Too, about, you know, have been simply impossible because people say they don't feel safe. Now, which is it? You know, are we saying that certain minorities are entitled to protection from speech and others aren't?
Well, take the case of trans. The reason it's impossible, isn't it, is what you mean is it's impossible to argue against it because that argument has been declared verboten.
Yes,
you
know, and I also mean that speakers have been no-platformed.
Yes.
I think that one of the reasons that Jewish people feel sore at the moment is that they've, particularly on campuses, is that they've watched this culture where free speech has been dwindling.
Yeah.
And then suddenly it's, you know, well...
It's an explosion of free speech.
And it's sticks and stones, you know.
Yeah.
Now,
right.
Yeah, you have to choose. And I think American campuses are a fork in the road here because they have to decide, are they going to be, you know, just basically creches for adults, right, where no one is exposed to ideas and thoughts that they might find hurtful, or are they going to be actually what universities should be, which is place of lively and sometimes, you know, fierce debate, not, you know, harassment to racial hatred, incitement to racial hatred or violence or vandalism. I'm not talking about that. But I think.
But is your sympathy then with excluding the nutcases with the, you know, Zionists must die and all of this nonsense, excluding those extreme people? Is your sympathy with the protesters?
Yes, it is. I mean, the protesters who are, to be clear, the protesters who are saying, which is not what I believe, you know, the whole Israel strategy is wrong and should be stopped tomorrow, and you know, this is all Israel's fault. They have 100% the right to say that.
How does this compare to Vietnam then? In 68?
Well, Vietnam is really interesting because I wrote my column in this week's European about this and the sort of echoes of 1968, and they are there, and we might talk a little bit about the implications for Trump v. Biden. But there are differences, and I think one of the key differences was that the anti-Vietnam protests were protests against governments and generals and the man, right? The problem with this one is of course, they're also protests against governments, the American government, the Israeli government, and so on.
Yeah.
But they're also protests against so-called Zionists, right? Which means in practice, Eddie from next door. You know, you find yourself protesting against your fellow students, and
yeah.
that's different.
Yeah.
And it creates a different and more complicated dynamic.
Yeah, yeah. No, it's, I get that. But again, it's the I can't speak on behalf of Palestinian protesters, or rather people protesting about Palestine on American campuses. But wouldn't they say, or most of them say, well, we're not. Most of us aren't protesting about Zionism per se.
Yes.
We're protesting about this.
They would.
Microcosm of they describe as
well,
a genocide.
They would. But here's the even trickier psychological problem, which is that very few racists admit they're racists or say they're racists,
yeah.
right? I mean, they say that they're just opposing Zionism.
Hmm.
Well, Zionism is a very complicated question. And, you know, most, and specifically the International Holocaust Remembrance Alliance's definition of anti-Semitism, it does include, you know, certain forms of anti-Zionism as forms of anti-Semitism.
Yeah.
Now, you know, it is, of course, you know, when you're on the barricades in Princeton or in Columbia,
yeah.
or you don't say, yeah, I'm a racist, I'm an anti-Semite.
No, wouldn't they say, well, look at what we're asking for, which is for a divestment from investment.
That's not all they're asking for, though.
Well, that's their core demand of the universities,
well,
isn't it?
Because the other
stuff they're asking for is out of their hands, isn't it?
Yeah, but they are demand. But hang on, they are actually.
Well, let me finish the. Let me.
Yeah,
finish
all right,
the
finish
point.
The thought.
They're asking for divestments in the government of in Israel, in the state of Israel, to damage the economy of Israel.
Perfectly legitimate demand.
Yes, and it's got nothing to do necessarily with the broader question of Zionism.
But I think it would be idle to deny that. That is not what they spend most of their days doing. What they
right.
spend most of their days doing when they're in these encampments is shouting about from the river to the sea and Zionism being, you know, an innately racist endeavor. And, you know, I mean, I heard a student, I think it was on the, the Today program, I believe from Columbia, talking about how, you know, basically Israel would just have to cease to exist and the Jews would have to go somewhere else. Now,
really?
Yeah, and I could tell from the woman's voice that she certainly considered herself to be a compassionate, kindly, and decent person.
Mm.
And the problem is, and it does come back to David Baddiel's Jews Don't Count, is that in the end, people do not see, will not accept Jewish people as a minority, as an ethnic minority. And until you get to that point, it's impossible, really, to make any progress.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, there's a whole, I mean, without going into the whole detail, there's this whole idea that Jews are essentially white, wrong, simply incorrect, right? There's an idea that they are powerful versus the powerless. Well, maybe with respect to Gaza, but, you know, Israel is surrounded by hostile countries.
Yes.
You know, and Jews have had 2,000 years of persecution. So,
absolutely, yeah.
So, you know, no, but, you know, it's really important because this has slotted, and this, I think, is one of the reasons why this, your point about this, the spread of this, is that it slots in wrongly but neatly into an incredibly prevalent contemporary template, which is powerful versus powerless, oppressor versus oppressed.
But I agree completely with that, with the error of that general narrative. And obviously that's the grounding of all of the prejudice against the Jewish people going, you know, you can go through Hitler, through all of them. It's all based on this idea that there's something devious and powerful and there's a conspiracy and they're the problem, you know.
Mm.
So, yes, but in this case where you've got people seeing the scale of the retribution against an impoverished and very vulnerable society that where it's now hard to separate from who the people who are being punished and the people who committed the crime, Hamas, where you've got more than 30 or maybe 40,000 people dead. Isn't it fair to say, well, in this instance, Israel clearly is the powerful, and the Palestinian people are the powerless, and they are getting absolutely brutalised. Isn't that a fair reaction?
Two responses to that. First of all, Hamas run Gaza is a proxy mini state of Iran, right?
This fine, is, but, all right, you, no, but you're hold avoiding on. The question.
No, I'm not avoiding the question. I totally acknowledge that what's happened in Gaza and is happening in Gaza today as we speak is an appalling slaughter.
Yeah.
But I want to put a question back to you, which is, ever since October the 7th, front pages of newspapers, news bulletins, we have seen the face of Benjamin Netanyahu, and rightly so, thousands of times, hundreds of thousands of times. Indeed, we've seen him again this week because of the question of whether the ceasefire, which is still in active negotiation, will go ahead. We almost never see ever the face of a man called Yahya Sinwar. Mm-hmm. Why is his face not on the front page of newspapers all over the world? Who is this man? He is the head of Hamas in Gaza. Mm. He has been the head of Hamas in Gaza since 2017. He planned October the 7th. He also, and this was a piece of, just in terms of military planning, a piece of bloodless but brilliant planning. He prepared the battlefield in advance because he knew Israel would retaliate. And he had built 5 kilometers of tunnels where Hamas personnel could go, but not civilians. And since October the 7th, he has done everything in his power to stop Palestinian civilians from being evacuated. He has shot them. He has aimed mortars at them. Yeah. During the pause last year, Sinwar moved 300,000 Palestinian civilians back into harm's way.
Mm.
He also is, you know, one of his lieutenants, Ghazi Hamad, said in November of October the 7th, we will do it twice and three times. Now, all I'm saying is, when you're up against, first of all, why is this guy never asked to do something, ever? I mean, you never ever read or see a protest saying, when will Sinwar, you know, end the conflict?
Isn't that because, I mean, I can't explain 100%, but isn't some of the rationale behind that the fact that this guy would be seen as clearly evil and not somebody who you would present as the solution to anything?
But, yeah, but hang on a minute. I mean,
I suppose you know, Bin Laden through, was a...
We've been through 7 months of Israel's evil.
Yeah.
You know, at what point does Yahya Sinwar become the... And also, I don't think that he is...
But your point... But for that logic to work in this... In the parameters of my question around the asymmetry of the vengeance, right?
Well, hang on. You could call it the asymmetry of the vengeance. Yeah. What was the appropriate retaliation?
Well, I don't know. But
no
probably,
one ever does.
No, but probably not killing 15,000 children.
What? Was the appropriate symmetry to go across the border and kill 1,200 civilians, take 150
well, no,
back?
Obviously
well, what
not.
Was it then?
Well, yes, but you're not denying, are you, that there is an asymmetry? I mean, there's always been an asymmetry in the response.
Of course, but that is what, when you are, we're not talking here, remember, we're not talking here about a terrorist incursion by a force that's thousands of miles away normally. We're talking about next door neighbours. We're talking about, you know, what Jewish people can see literally over the horizon.
Yes,
you know.
Yeah.
What was the reasonable, proportionate response to what happened on October the 7th? The sexual violence, the murder of infants? Yeah.
I don't know.
No one does,
know.
But this is the problem. Is
I don't know, but I don't buy the argument that because I can't answer that question and nobody can, I don't buy the argument that that is equals carte blanche to any response.
No, I don't think it means carte blanche. And by the way, and again, this is a very unpopular point, and I'm aware that I'm digging myself a hole here. The ratio of combatants to civilians killed in Gaza, though still horrific, is way lower than it has been in other conflicts. I mean, what you have here is a situation where Hamas wanted to stop a shift towards a two-state solution, and it wanted Israel to do something that would make that an impossibility for a generation. And it's probably succeeded. Mm. It's probably succeeded in an objective. But what you have to remember is that the minute that October the 7th happened, no reasonable person could expect Israelis ever again to negotiate with Hamas. Mm. So for all the talk of let's have a ceasefire, let's have a two-state solution. Okay, a ceasefire, but is Hamas still operative?
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Two-state solution, forget it. It's not going to happen. You know, I really hope it happens in my lifetime, yeah. But I'm less sure because Hamas and at the moment, the full spectrum of Israeli political opinion is against it.
Isn't there a bit of... Yeah, no, look, I think that's totally right, but isn't there a conflation between... or in those arguments about what's the right response, what should Israel do, What is the future with Hamas still in existence? Isn't that helping to conflate Hamas with the people of Palestine?
No, because we accept Hamas's 30,000 civilians dead, right?
Yeah.
Well, let's accept for now the IDF's report that it has managed to disable 20 of 24 Hamas battalions, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
It is very close.
Yeah.
To degrading Hamas as a viable military force, right?
Yeah.
This is why the incursion into Rafah, which in fact has already begun, is so contested because, you know, the West is saying, look, you know, stop it, you've done enough. Netanyahu, and not just Netanyahu, by the way, some of the politicians who are proposed as more biddable successors like Benny Gantz are saying exactly the same.
Mm.
Until we get into Rafah and we get the last remaining leaders of Hamas, the job is not done.
Yes.
Now, what's interesting here is that, and we haven't really mentioned this yet, but it sort of gets us back into real events, is that Joe Biden has made a massive announcement in that he has said categorically in a CNN interview that he won't supply Israel with weapons to bombard Rafah.
Yeah.
Now, that's a big moment. It's less...
And it's worth pausing just to talk about what weapons we're talking about.
Because they're
2,000 and 5,000-pound bombs.
Yes. Yeah, but the reason, again...
It's not highly targeted.
I'm in danger of becoming an IDF spokesman, which I don't want to be. But the reason that those bombs are necessary is because Sinwar had built such a subterranean tunnel... network,
but
right?
Isn't Biden saying the bloody obvious, which is if you drop 2,000 pound bombs anywhere to blow up a tunnel, you're going to kill shed loads of innocent civilians as well?
Yes, he
and
is.
It's not going to happen.
Yes, and well, it
isn't that reasonable.
Except that, again, you know, and I know you've adopted the position that you don't have to come up with an alternative strategy. What are the Israelis
let me meet you halfway and say what would be super helpful is if there was a sense of what would happen after Israel considers the job done.
Right, well, now we're at the bone. I really think this is the most interesting bit. So I think there will be a ceasefire. I think that we're actually closer to it than... has been reported that we came very close at the beginning of the week and then Hamas rewrote it. Netanyahu said not near Nelly, but the CIA director, William J. Burns, is practically living down there at the moment. And although it is always complicated, I think that the prospect of a ceasefire is better than it's ever been. The question is what happens next and who is in charge. Now, The worrying thing about what the Biden administration wants to do, conscious of legacy, is it wants to get immediately going with two-state solution talk. And this, I think, is really not good, is a trilateral Saudi-Israel-US agreement, sort of the finish off the Abraham Accords that President Trump started. I think that's a ridiculous way to look at it. It's far too big scale. The first thing that needs to happen is that we need a massive Marshall Plan style infrastructural reconstruction plan that's going to last 5 to 10 years.
For Gaza.
And that is in the ceasefire document that's doing the rounds, and that's good.
Yeah.
And that's going to cost the international community a lot of money and money well spent, right? The trickier business, and to this I don't have an answer to is who runs Gaza sort of pro tem. The suggestion is a mixture of Egypt, Qatar, and UN. We'll see, right? And then the final question, which is the important one, is where do we find a Palestinian actor, a group, an agency, with whom Israel can negotiate?
Yeah, yeah.
Because once this stops, and one hopes it stops much sooner rather than much later, there's going to have to be a new Palestinian entity with which Israelis can step by step negotiate.
But of course, sadly, and this is just an inevitable consequence of what's happened, whoever's right, whoever's wrong, is that the levels of hostility now.
Yes.
I mean, you've got tens of thousands, whichever number you believe, but you've got tens of thousands of people who have been orphaned, widowed, who've lost children, who are deeply, deeply psychologically embittered now against Israel. You know, if they wanted to
traumatize Israel.
You know, and the same on the other side as well. You've got Israel.
This is why I keep coming. I mean, I slightly in order to steel man things. I always try in these debates to put the Israeli point of view, because very few people do, right?
Right.
And the fact is that, you know, what happened on October the 7th, which has largely been not erased, but it's been put aside as it was a horrible thing, but Israel has massively overreacted. The idea that Israel is the overreactor is a familiar thing for people. People feel comfortable saying that.
Right.
It fits into the box.
But can I just pause just for one second? Because I didn't feel like that, but I do now. So I've been on a journey. I remember listening to Johnny Friedland's podcast and being absolutely won over by his co-host's argument that, you know, people keep saying there's a clock, there's a timetable on Israel. Yeah. People are always checking Israel, and that was rooted in a kind of supranational anti-Semitism. You know, it was kind of like Israel was treated as a special case. And I've bought into that, and I sort of, and I still do, generally speaking. But again, on the specifics of what's happened in the last 7 months, as time has gone on, I just look absolutely bewildered at the base fact that, you know, 20, 30, 40,000 innocent people have died.
What it isn't is bewildering. It may be, in your view, horribly unethical and wrong, right? But it isn't bewildering.
Well, it bewilders me.
Well, because that was, this is the conflict that was set up by October the 7th.
Yes,
October
the 7th
was an ingenious step forward. I mean, it nothing like it had been seen, perhaps since My Lai or something. I don't know what, but that isn't really a proper precedent.
Yeah.
It guaranteed that the Israelis would have to eradicate Hamas from Gaza, which of course, as you imply, is a task that would necessarily involve the deaths of many civilians. And as I keep coming back to this, no one, you know, in 7 months of thousands of articles, hundreds of podcasts, no one has come up with a solution that does not really mean just Israel stop.
No
one has come up with a plan for what Israel would do if it stopped completely now and Hamas continued to be an active force in Gaza.
Okay. I mean, look, obviously it's bloody complicated. And the other thing that I can hear people kind of screaming at their whatever headphones, whatever they listen to this podcast on, is that, you know, we're discussing this as though October the 7th was day one, you know, and of course there's a very compelling argument to say, No. You've got to look much further back. And this is, everything is a reaction and a reaction and a reaction. And it's escalated in its reaction. And, you know, I just think there's a valid argument for people to say in this case, my conviction is that the people of Palestine have been treated badly for a long time. Hamas is a reaction to that treatment. We can then go further back and say, well, the reason Israel treats Hamas like that is a reaction to the way they've been treated. And you can take it back as far as you like, but it becomes a very circular argument. And at some point, someone's got to be the big guy and break out of that circularity. And I'm not saying, you know, there would be no reaction and that Israel would be expected to turn the other cheek to what Hamas did. Of course not. But my question is, has what Israel's done since October the 7th made a longer term solution for either people closer or further away?
I don't know, but I always balk at the idea that it's only Israel's responsibility to find a longer term solution.
But you said earlier
that, you know, the leader of Hamas was an evil man.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Which is basically saying he's over here with all the evil guys.
Well, no, I'm saying he is.
Hamas is an evil and irrational force, whereas Israel is part of the family of nations.
No, I said he was an evil man. Well, this guy who drags 300,000 people to be victims, you know, and to accelerate the drama and the crisis.
But he had 4,000 people, some of them civilians, behind him in 22 incursion points on October the 7th. I mean, what the problem in all of these things is what I always call unpalatable truths, right? Mm. There is a very familiar way of discussing the Middle East, and it has mostly prevailed since October the 7th. And by the way, if you want me to criticize Israel, the biggest criticism I would make of them, other than, you know, I regret the loss of life in Gaza, but the biggest criticism has been a total failure of public diplomacy. Netanyahu has been a disaster in explaining to the world what's going on. And specifically, it was a grotesque error not to allow Western journalists and other journalists to go embedded with the IDF into Gaza so they can say, this is why we're doing this, this is why we're doing that. As it is, people's impression of what's going on in Gaza has been wholly crafted by Hamas, Palestinian civilians, Palestinian journalists, you know. And I think that for that, Israel will pay a price, actually. It was a very bad decision.
Yeah. I mean, obviously, there's been ammunition, metaphorically speaking, that the Palestinian journalists have been handed by some of the behaviour by the IDF. But that point about not coming enough from Netanyahu about what the solution is and what the plan is where I was trying to meet you halfway before, which is because right now the plan just looks like wipe Gaza off the face of the earth.
That's
what it looks like.
It may look like it, but it isn't. I mean, look, Israel is a military giant, right?
Yeah.
If it wanted to wipe Gaza off the face of the earth, if it really was committed to what people call genocide, this would look even worse, right? I mean, I know it is extremely unfashionable to say this, but in fact, the IDF, you know, it handed out leaflets, it called people on their phones, it hovered drones over areas saying this area is going to be attacked. Which other country ever has done something like that?
Well, Iran did it when it was attacking Israel. Telegraphed its attack, didn't it?
All right, fair enough. Yeah. I mean, it though not to the civilians. But okay, but what I'm saying is that there was a direct attempt to minimise civilian casualties, right? But the fact is that we've forgotten what warfare is like. You know, if you make an attack like October the 7th, there is a very high likelihood that, and you know, that basically the Second World War was this. You know, the outcome is going to involve civilian death on a scale that is really, really difficult to take. And now we have technology that presses it into our faces all the time.
Yeah.
And the bigger question, and this is for another day when things are calmer and, you know, hopefully something like peace is returned, is it actually possible to fight wars like this? You know, I mean, or is the reality that, you know, Israel will just have to accept that it can't do stuff like this if it wants to remain part of the international community? And if it's told that, will it want to remain part of the international community? I mean, I hope it does, but I must say that I think that the framing has been skewed.
We started
bit of a domestic there.
Ripples in a pond, and the ripples have extended.
No, but it's good. It's really important, and I'll tell you why it's important. It's because I think that because we respect each other, I think we can say these things without fear or favour.
Yeah, totally.
What worries me about this war is that the kind of discussion we've just had happens almost never.
Yeah, yeah.
Right?
I think that's absolutely true. Yeah.
You know, I mean, it's like we've probably changed each other's minds by 5%.
Yeah.
But that's a start.
No, no, for sure. And just having the conversation. I mean, the other point I want to make is that our conversation, the students on the campuses, the universities divesting from Israel, the protests in London every weekend, none of it matters, really. None of it makes any difference, really. What will make a difference is governments.
Yes, you're right.
Talking together.
Yeah.
And putting pressure on both sides. I think the time has come where there's got to be some pressure and some leverage.
Well, I think you're seeing that from Biden now.
Yeah.
And actually, you know, one of the interesting things about this is that it's unusual for Biden to do this. It's not actually that unusual for American presidents. I mean, Reagan and Bush Sr. frequently, clouted Israel and said, you can't have this unless you do that. And it's, there is scope always for the American-Israel relationship to be used as a lever in this.
Yeah.
And I wouldn't be pessimistic about that.
Well, my only optimism, and it feels terrible saying, even using the phrase optimism in the middle of such horror.
No.
But the optimism, that it feels like we are at rock bottom. And it feels like the only way is up from here. But
well, I think what's happening is that the detail of the ceasefire is actually now so great that it's beginning to develop the form of a immediate post-conflict plan.
Yeah.
And these things, which is not to say that by the next time we meet for a podcast, you know, everything will have been sorted.
Yeah.
But I do think that we are at... Let's put it no more than this. We're at a fork in the road, and I think that there is a 30% chance that we might get a ceasefire quite quickly. I would put it no higher than that, but that's higher than I would have thought of at any stage so far.
Well, let's end it on that positive note.
There you
go. We'll come back. We've reached a fork in the road, and we're going to come back after a short break with something totally different.
Totally different.
Cultural.
And jolly.
Yeah.
So, retrospectors, what historical events are we ticking off on this week's run of Today in History?
Well, on Tuesday, we head to the battlefields of medieval Spain to witness the very first ambulance.
On Wednesday, it's the anniversary of the day Coca-Cola's creator hit on his winning formula. He dropped the wine, but kept the cocaine.
On Thursday, the thief who stuffed the crown jewels down his trousers.
And on Friday, when free-spirited Danish parenting put 90s New York in her tears.
We discuss this and more on Today in History with the Retrospectors. 10 minutes every weekday, wherever you get your podcasts.
My business used to be weighed down by the complexities of in-person payments. Then, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe came along and changed everything. With Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, I streamlined my payment process effortlessly. Now I can accept in-person, contactless payments right from my iPhone. No extra hardware required. What's truly remarkable is how I can cater to all of my customers' payment preferences. Whether they're using cards, Apple Pay, or other digital wallets, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe ensure a smooth checkout experience every time. And it's not just me. Stripe helps businesses of all sizes, from local markets to global retailers, scale quickly and stay agile. To learn how Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe can help grow your revenue and reach, visit stripe.com/tapiphone.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Wow!
Nice!
Yeah! What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
So, Matt, you have come back from seeing a stage production of my favourite film in history ever.
You know what? I had such a good trip. It was went up to Birmingham Rep, which is a great theatre, and a wonderful place to launch this new stage production of Bruce Robertson's With an Eye, which I think possibly for our generation is like holy writ, isn't it?
Yeah.
You know, many a centrist dad has irritated people by quoting at length, you know, are you the farmer?
Well, just to say, I watched it with my 17-year-old daughter.
Enjoy it.
Who loved it. She absolutely loved it.
I mean, I have to say, I think it does get through the Checkpoint Charlie of generational, because my kids both love it too. So it's not, and that's actually relevant to what I thought. So Bruce Robertson has always resisted the idea of staging the movie. And the movie it's a funny one, really, because nothing much happens in it. It's about two struggling actors subsisting on booze and speed in Camden Town in 1969. Yeah. And they decide that they are drifting into the arena of the unwell and that they're going to go on holiday to Withnall, who's played by Richard E. Grant. His uncle Monty, who's played by Richard Griffiths, has a remote cottage in Cumbria, and they're going to go there for a holiday, and it's all horrible. And then Uncle Monty turns up and the place transforms into a sort of, you know, English eccentrics paradise.
Yeah.
And Uncle Monty makes a move on I, who is played by Paul McGann, also called Marwood in the script. And then they go home.
Yeah.
Which really doesn't capture the sort of magic and the dialogue and the music. And so, you know, it's taken Robinson a long time to commit himself to this. And I think what made the difference was Sean Foley, who's a brilliant, he's the artistic director of Birmingham Rep, kind of persuaded Bruce Robinson, we can do this. And more to the point, it won't just be a sort of bloodless reenactment of the movie. You know, it'll have its own life.
Right.
You know, it'll be true to the script, and the script is mostly the same. There are bits and bobs that have changed, but nothing much.
Have they carried it off?
And they have. Wonderful. I mean, I'll tell you why I think it works. So number one, the people that play the main parts, Robert Sheehan plays Withnall, Adonis Siddique plays Marwood stroke I, and Malcolm Sinclair plays Uncle Monty. And it's really to their credit that they don't just mimic the movie performances.
Yeah.
So, you know, I mean, obviously the characters have their own boundaries, but it's not like watching the film on stage at all.
Yes.
And then there are lots of fun things, like the set design is incredibly ingenious, because if you think about, you know, they're on the road in Marwood's Jag Mark II, and you know they're in the countryside
up at Crow Crag,
Jake the poacher, we've
gone on holiday by mistake.
We've gone on holiday. Are you the farmer? Of course he's the fucking farmer, Withnall. Stop saying that. And one of the things that I thought made it was a particularly clever idea, simple, but just made it more vivid and real. And now was they've got a very good live band playing the music, music. So you've got, and that really works. So it gives it.
Do they do that lovely melodic theme?
They do White Shed of Pale. They do the Hendrix classics, and so it's it has this kind of sense that it's breathing life into, you know, it's a production in its own right. It's breathing life into a movie we all love.
Yeah.
It is homage to the movie. There's no question about it, but it has its own life. And I really hope it gets to tour. And then I really hope it gets a West End transfer. It is really, I really admire them because, you know, Withnall is, to an almost crazy extent, treated as holy writ, you know, and this breaks the crust of reverence.
Well, it's set in Camden, or starting Camden in 1969, which is the year I was born. So there's it kind of feels like the world when I was four or five, you know, it's that kind of magic nostalgia, but it's such a great film.
It is, and it's about, it's a very moving film because it's, I think Robinson is semi-autobiographical about his early life as a struggling actor. But it's also about his simultaneous contempt for and absolute love of English eccentricity.
Yes.
And it's also a movie stroke play about endings.
Oh.
You know, the end of a decade, the end of a social order, the end of friendship.
Yeah.
And as Danny, the drug dealer, says, very well played in this, the greatest decade in the history of humanity is coming to an end, man. And as presuming Ed here has so consistently pointed out, we have failed to paint it black. And I don't know why, but that particular elegiac line always puts a lump in my throat.
Well, the bit that puts I'm more basic than you, and the bit that always puts a lump in my throat is the very last scene where he stands outside the London Zoo.
With the wolves.
And I have found the exact railings he stands by, and I've found the exact bench that you walk past. And it's because it's easy to sort of track it. And of course, the wolves are no longer in that bit of the zoo.
Right, yeah.
It's near the penguin enclosure now. But where he starts reading from Hamlet, and the rain starts coming down.
I have a fleet, they were for I know not.
And walks off, and you just think, oh my God, you know, it's a bit of all of us there. You know?
In the original script that Robinson was going to shoot, Whittle goes back to his flat and kills himself.
Oh, really?
Yeah, which would have been a big mistake because the movie and the stage play, I don't want to sort of spoil how they do it, but carries off this sense of melancholy as well.
Yeah.
Is the sense that people do just part.
Yeah.
It's about sunderings and partings and the sadness and the richness of experience. And it's great. It's great.
And so, the film was all produced by the great late George Harrison.
Yeah. I mean, and would not have happened
without George Harrison.
And it's wonderful that also there were some fantastic early miscasting ideas, like having Daniel Day-Lewis is Withnall,
which
would have required, you know, 16 months of preparation. And,
you know,
Kenneth Branagh as well, I think, was in line.
Oh, really?
But, yeah.
That would have been interesting, Branagh. That would have changed Branagh's career completely.
It would, but, you know, there's something about, I think, Richard E. Grant's sort of almost cadaverous.
It's perfect.
You know.
The scene where he's applying the
imbrocation,
the liniment all over him.
And wonderfully, because he's teetotal, of course.
Yeah,
so
yeah,
playing a drunkard was
amazing.
But it's a great film.
But you know, Harrison was too tight to pay for the... Robinson had written in scenes for, obviously, expensive scenes, filming on the motorways.
Right.
The actual drive to Crag...
Yeah, Crag, yeah.
And Harrison was too tight. So Robinson paid for those scenes himself.
Bloody hell.
And cut them in. And of course, you kind of think, without that linking scene of them driving through the night with the rain lashing in on the Jag, you know, and all of that, it would have really kind of been an unsettling transition from Uncle Monty's to straight into Crow Crag.
It would have been, yeah. No, you need that.
Yes, and he knew that, and he said, no, the hell.
And then on the
paying.
Way back, yeah. I'm making time.
That's
don't be ridiculous. My cousin's a QC. Get to the back of the van! Sorry, this is very...
I wonder if there's anybody listening who hasn't seen Withnail and I.
Well, if you haven't, you're missing a treat, and I hope that this play comes. But I think there's just... I mean, it's there's no other film like it.
Yeah.
But it's interesting, isn't it, that some of these great movies are now being transferred to play, or TV series. So we're looking forward to Boys from the Black Stuff.
Amazing.
Which is coming up, which has been adapted from Alan Bleasdale's classic.
Yeah.
Coming to the National Theatre on May 22nd after a successful
run. And you've bought us tickets for that.
I have.
Can't wait. Yeah.
That's a timely segue. Another segue. One of our great segues, which we have justly celebrated, to R.I.P. Bernard Hill.
Yeah. Yeah.
Who played Yossa Hughes, Gizzard Job, in the original and timelessly classic.
Yeah. Can I clear something up about the word Yossa, just briefly?
I would love it if you did.
Mark Lawson wrote a very good obituary of Bernard Hill.
Yes.
And talked about the character, obviously Yossa Hughes, and said that since Boys from the Black Stuff, the name Yossa as a nickname has carried on, you know, and he knew somebody called Hughes from Liverpool who was called Yozza. But the gag is that everybody in Liverpool, for time immemorial, who's called Hughes, which is pronounced Hughes, is called Yozza. It's just a Liverpool.
It's like,
everyone's called Yozza. So the gag
like
is
Smitty
that,
or
yeah, but it's calling him Yozza Hughes is like Yozza Yozza or Hughes
Smitty,
Hughes.
Smitty, Smitty, yeah,
yeah, yeah. But yeah. But it's that one thing Alan Bleasdale can't claim credit for is inventing the phrase.
Right. That's yeah. very interesting. So yeah. Bernard Hill, who you know went on to have all sorts of acting credits in movies and big series, died on Sunday. But what an exit he made, because we've both been enjoying
Responder.
The Martin Freeman, Tony Schumacher TV series, season two of The Responder, in which Bernard Hill plays Tom, who is the father of Chris, who's the copper played by Martin Freeman.
Yeah.
And... Well, I'll leave it to you to explain why he's so brilliant.
He's brilliant because he brings that... I mean, Bernard Hill is brilliant for a start. Because he has the... And I forget what Mark Lawson said, but it was something about a sort of controlled rage that could turn at any moment.
Yeah, exactly.
And there is a moment in... You'll know, I won't spoil it for people, but there's a moment in, I think, the third episode Bernard Hill, his acting... in this scene
gobsmacking
is oh my god, you know, it's like wow, it's incredible and it's brutal and it's but where the as I'm sure Bernard Hill were alive to say so would admit is that it's the genius of the writing that facilitates that incredible turn of acting. And
stunning
this guy
writing.
Tony Schumacher
is a genius,
stands alongside Alan Bleasdale I'm concerned
You know, one wonders, is he the new Alan Bleasdale?
Yeah, well, quite easily. Because if to describe this as a cop drama...
Yeah, it's so much more than that.
It'd be like describing King Lear as an episode of Neighbours. You know, it's not... It's absolutely intense and incredible.
It's a state of the nation.
Isn't it?
It's riveting. And the final example of this trend is to come later in the year, in October, which is Stanley Kubrick's Dr. Strangelove is... going on stage.
Oh, really?
As reimagined by Amanda Iannucci and Sean Foley, who did the Withnall in Birmingham.
Am I imagining that Steve Coogan's in that?
And
that...
Steve Coogan is taking the Peter Sellers
role. Yes,
so we'll
right.
see. Yeah. I mean, you know, what a team. And and I guess there's a sort of interesting question here, which is it all this sort of putting of old TV series, films, whatever, onto the stage, is it just nostalgia, lack of courage, squeezing as much juice as you can out of old intellectual property? And certainly, you know, if you walk down Shaftesbury Avenue now, there are musicals and things that are based on movies, and you really wish they wouldn't. They weren't.
Yeah, yeah.
But I sort of feel in these three cases, with Withnall, Boys from the Black Stuff, Dr. Strangelove, there's... It's good to see them being fresh life being brought. I mean, to take, you know, we've talked about Boys in the Black Stuff a lot on the podcast as a sort of reference point and a kind of the kind of alarming echoes today about the social fabric. But, you know, Strangelove, this week, Putin ordered nuclear drills.
Yeah, yeah.
Who would have thought 1964, when Kubrick's film came out, that in 2024 it would be still
living out
horrifically relevant?
Well, I tell you what I think the answer to why this phenomenon is, that all the money suddenly has gone towards TV series, you know, Amazon and Disney and Paramount and
100%.
All of Netflix, obviously. And that's where the talent's gravitated to. So what you're seeing is... absolutely first, I mean, and not just recently, we're talking maybe of the last 20 years, The West Wing, The Sopranos, you know, Breaking Bad, The Wire, you know, these absolutely time immemorial classics that would in another time have been made as movies first, I guess, because that's where the money was.
That's true.
And the money's moved to TV, and so now this is where all the amazing artwork is happening, and it's a glorious time for television.
It is, and I, you know, I like the idea of staging of things, you know, with the proviso, I suppose, that going to the theatre is expensive.
Yeah.
But it's nice to see the I guess it's quality, isn't it? I mean, when it's classics like this, it's hard to object to them being given a different. And not all of them will work.
And by the way, I must tip my hat towards you, because half of this stuff I read now, having read your wonderful cultural column each week.
Oh, well, thank you very much. The newsletter. Sheet. Well, yeah. In which Withnall and I, the stage play and the Responder will both figure.
Brilliant.
It's out today, Friday.
Brilliant.
And available to
presently European subscribers. And just another great reason to subscribe. Quick hat tip to Ripley as well on Netflix, which...
Oh, isn't it great?
Was absolutely wonderful.
I mean, you know, tremendous. And again, another example of how reinterpretation can... Because, you know, a lot of people have played Ripley from not just Matt Damon, but Alain Delon and John Malkovich. And I didn't know until I was looking into the Netflix series, because I enjoyed Andrew Scott's interpretation.
Yeah, brilliant.
I didn't know Dennis Hopper... had a go. Yeah.
Had he really?
Yes, he did. I mean, I've yet to see the version. I must catch up with it. But I find it very, very difficult to imagine old crazy Dennis as Ripley.
Do you know the oldest fact about Dennis Hopper is that he's mad about transcendental meditation?
Dennis Hopper was crazy about TM.
He's absolutely...
He's dead now.
Yeah, or he was. He's transcending transcendental meditation.
He has now transcended everything, really.
He's yogi flying off to another plane. But he was... Yeah, and he used to fund, like, anybody he'd met, he would, like, put them on a TM course.
I suppose the truth is that, you know, when you've ingested as much... when you've been as chemically challenged as Dennis, you've got to get obsessed by something else, haven't you?
You need a distraction. Yeah.
R.I.P. And R.I.P.
The great Bernard Hill.
The great Bernard Hill, because really... You know, they broke the mold with that one, I think.
Gives a job. I can do that.
I can do that.
So, Matt, thank you as ever for another challenging this time, but
challenging and jolly.
Still enjoyable conversation.
Laced with optimism.
Yeah.
You have to find it, but it's there.
If you found this conversation stimulating, get your questions, any feedback into the two Matts, that's the number two, M-A-T-T-S, at tnepublishing.com. Two Matts at tnepublishing.com. Or if you listen on Spotify, you can message us there, and that's what John did. And he says, first listen now on the roster. Not a question, but thank you, John. Thank you.
You've
had loads of good feedback, actually, from listeners.
So much obliged.
Thank you very much for all the positive response. If you like it, tell everybody you know, and subscribe and like the show, whatever you need to do. We'll have loads of questions and answers in our usual Q&A session on Sunday, so please join us then. And remember our subscription offer. If you like the Two Matts podcast, I personally guarantee you will love getting the New European newspaper every week. Go to theneweuropean.co.uk/2Matts, number two, M-A-T-T-S, and there's a link in the show notes. Thank you to producer Matt Hill at Rethink Audio with support from Ollie Peart. And until next week...
It's goodbye from me.
It's goodbye from him.
Goodbye. Goodbye.
My business used to be weighed down by the complexities of in-person payments. Then, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe came along and changed everything. With Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, I streamlined my payment process effortlessly. Now I can accept in-person, contactless payments right from my iPhone. No extra hardware required. What's truly remarkable is how I can cater to all of my customers' payment preferences, whether they're using cards, Apple Pay, or other digital wallets, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe ensure a smooth checkout experience every time. And it's not just me. Stripe helps businesses of all sizes, from local markets to global retailers, scale quickly and stay agile. To learn how Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe can help grow your revenue and reach, visit stripe.com/tapiphone.
Hey, welcome to the Next Wave podcast. Consider us your chief AI officer in your business. My name is Matt Wolf. I have the number one YouTube channel in the AI space. I also run FutureTools.com, and I'm joined by my co-host, Nathan Lands, founder of Lore.com. We want to bring you the latest AI news and trends, show you how you can use AI in your business and personal life, and help make it super easy for you to understand and execute. We're going to equip you with the knowledge to thrive in this upcoming wave of change.
So, retrospectors, what historical events are we ticking off on this week's run of Today in History?
Well, on Monday, it's the anniversary of the table knife being invented.
On Tuesday, we explain how the tradition of the two-minute silence originated in Cape Town.
On Wednesday, we recall the day King George III proved he was assassin-proof.
On Thursday, let's all eat cake. It's Marie Antoinette's wedding.
And on Friday, we discover how Buffalo Bill helped invent the Wild West.
We discuss this and more on Today in History with the Retrospectors. 10 minutes each weekday, wherever you get your podcasts.